In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 371. We're talking about the concept of private cities today, inspired by a paper co-authored by our guest, Alex Tabarrok. Alex holds the Bartley J. Madden Chair in Economics at the Mercatus Center, and he's a professor of economics at George Mason University. He blogs at Marginal Revolution, a blog he co-founded, and we're linking to several of his books on the show notes page for today, which is tomwoods.com/371. So let's turn now to my conversation with Alex Tabarrok. Alex, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
I'd like to talk about a paper of yours that you co-authored that has to do with, first, the general subject of private cities, although you're focusing on a particular one, and then at the end you talk about other examples. But first of all, tell me about this private city in India. I'm frankly not sure how to pronounce it.
So there is a private city, which is Gurgaon, India. It's just outside Delhi. And what is interesting about it is that it's been very, very difficult to build anything in India, converting land from agricultural uses to non-agricultural uses is incredibly complicated and bureaucratized and a big pain. And the state in which Gurgaon is located, it lifted some of these restrictions. It sort of centralized them and made it easier to get through these restrictions. And since that time, around the 1990s, Gurgaon has grown tremendously from a really basically a village, 100,000 or fewer people. It's now over 2 million people. It's a city. It's filled with skyscrapers. It's got one of the largest malls in the world, the Mall of India. It's got golf courses. It's the home to Fortune 500 companies. I mean, it has just exploded in growth. And it's been almost entirely privately driven because while the state government lifted some of these restrictions, they did nothing else to help this city along. It was scrubland. There's been no city government. There's been almost no involvement from the state government or the national government, and it's all grown privately. It's fantastic in many ways, as I'm sure we'll get to shortly. It has also got some problems.
Well, how exactly does something like that get started, given that the state wants to be involved in everything? Was just a matter of they didn't have the resources, and so people just went ahead without the state? Or what? How can we account for this? What interest would the state have in allowing something like this to go on?
So we have to be careful when talking about the state, especially in India. It's more like there's like 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 states. There are all these different bureaucracies, and they compete with one another in many ways, state and local bureaucracies and different divisions. And what happened in Haryana was that it was more of a sort of a centralization. So the central minister's office in the state of Haryana got control over this process, and nobody much cared because this was sort of waste scrubland. So instead of having a dozen different bureaucracies that you had to go through, you only had to go through the state minister's office. So it wasn't like laissez-faire in that sense. It was more like, okay, now we just know who we have to bribe. Okay, and we've just got to bribe this one guy, and he'll give us license to this big tract of land. There's nobody on this land. There's no other local governments. So once we have this piece of land, we can do what we want with it. So that was the story. It was just a smoothing of the a process rather than sort of pure laissez-faire.
Well, in a way, it kind of reminds me of the formation of cities in medieval Europe. during the feudal days, when you would have people who wanted to start a city, and they would have a kind of negotiation with whoever was ruling the area that we will pay you X dollars in taxes, but we expect self-government and various liberties and commercial freedom and so on and on. And they were able to carve out what turned out to be eventually the most vibrant part of European society at that time. Do you see any analogy with this?
Absolutely. I think that's a very good analogy. It was a carving out an island of freedom amid this bureaucratic chaos elsewhere.
All right. So tell us about let's go through what the scorecard shows, so to speak, in terms of the pros and the cons. So as you say, you have here what looks on the surface to be a thriving city. You have people who want to be there, including Fortune 500 companies, perfectly happy being there, and yet it is not like any other city you've ever seen. So it does seem on the surface to have quite a few successes, but then there are difficulties. I want to know how infrastructure fits into this. Has that been a success or a difficulty?
So that's where the biggest difficulty is. So you had these developers, and they got these tracts of land. Within the tract of land, everything is great. So the actual building of the structures, the mall, the golf courses, whatever it happens to be, everything is great. But between the tracts of land, it's a complete disaster. So to give you an example, you have these wonderful skyscrapers, but the sewage, it doesn't actually go to a central sewage treatment plant. Instead, quite often what happens is the sewage will go to a truck. And then the truck takes it out and dumps it somewhere, perhaps into the river, perhaps into some unoccupied land, some state land. So it's a very primitive system. The surface, you know, is gleaming and beautiful, but underneath is this primitiveness of picking up the sewage and, you know, trucking it out and dumping it. Much the same thing is true about the electricity system. So the central system, what little of it exists, is you have outages all the time. It doesn't work very well. You know, you can't rely on it at all. So private firms have built private systems, which, again, they work great for you. These Fortune 500 companies, they need reliable electricity. They're doing a lot of information technology, you know, transfer telephone calls and so forth, and they get reliable electricity, but it's generated by diesel. That's okay, but it's inefficient compared to having a central plant. So you get more pollution, it's higher cost, and overall it's not as efficient. Same kind of thing is true with water, not just the sewage system, but the water system, completely unreliable. Often these developments are not connected to a central system. Instead, water is trucked in and delivered out of tanks. So you have much higher costs. Your average costs are much higher when you're delivering water by tank than if you can have a central system and, you know, you have increasing returns to scale, you push those average costs down. So what has really happened is that the government completely failed in what at least a neoclassical economist would think of as its standard tax of producing some of these goods, which have, you know, really large economies of scale. It completely failed in delivering sewage and delivering electricity and delivering water. Private suppliers have taken up the task, but at considerably higher cost and less efficiency. Now, when looking at this, I must say, I actually thought that I would see over time the private firms coming together to produce more of this infrastructure. As I said, the infrastructure is great on these private property parcels, but the firms haven't got together. They haven't been able to connect these parcels with one another. So you have these islands of private efficient planning, but you haven't got the large infrastructure, which is really helpful to making a, you know, vibrant city.
Well, before we try and hash out how these difficulties might be overcome, let's see the other side of the ledger. What can compensate for these difficulties? You may have seen a piece in Salon several weeks ago that was claiming that Honduras, of all places, was in the process of becoming a libertarian paradise, and which of course means it's terrible for everybody. It's unfit for human habitation now because they're beginning to develop so-called free cities. Not exactly what you were describing here, but not a million miles remote from it either. And so anytime, if you were to describe the idea of a private city to somebody at Ceylon, they would go completely berserk. So what are the pros that you can say in its favor?
So there's a few things. Again, looking at Gurgaon, there have been very marked successes. I've already mentioned, the skyscrapers and the malls and so forth. But in addition, private security has worked very, very well. So there's far more private security officers in Gurgaon than there are police officers. There's something like 30 or 40,000 private security officers. So malls have their own security. Most housing developments have their own security. Even houses will contract to have their own private security forces. And that has worked very well. It's a safe city. Fire provision also provided almost entirely private, much better than the public system. Public system, completely unreliable, doesn't even have the capability. Their fire trucks, they don't reach the top of the skyscrapers. So the private developers had to produce their own fire systems because, otherwise their property was under threat. So Gurgaon has the only, or perhaps the only one of two private fire departments in all of India, and it's one of the best provided department, has one of the best equipments in all of India. And there's one other point which I need to make, Tom, and that is, even though Gurgaon has all of these failings, which I've pointed to in sewage, in electricity, in water, it's actually not bad compared to the rest of India. So let's remember, it was only a few years ago when India had the world's biggest blackout. I don't know if you remember, but 600-700 million people were without power for weeks on end. Just almost the entire continent had a gigantic blackout. Most Indian cities don't have central sewage systems. Most Indian cities don't have a reliable electricity system. So if we compare Gurgaon to the average in India, it's actually still pretty good. It's just worse than it would have been either with the benevolent dictator or a optimally social planner or an optimum government. And it's worse perhaps that it could be with a different private structure, as we may get to.
This reminds me of a point that Ben Powell and maybe even Pete Leeson has made about Somalia. They've run right in and talked about Somalia instead of running away from it. They've said that the correct benchmark of comparison is not to compare Somalia with the United States in the same way that we don't want to unfairly compare Gurgaon to, let's say, Boston. The relevant comparison would be a comparable Indian city and the level that it's reached in terms of infrastructure. But yes, I do want to, because you do toward the end of the paper, try to go through, tick off a few possible ways that these difficulties might be overcome. Tell me what you've come up with.
Yeah. So before I get to that, let me just add that one point on what you just last said is that some of the smartest, best people in India are actually flocking to Gurgaon. That's one of the reasons why it's been successful, these high-tech workers. So you can also see that compared to other Indian cities, people want to be there despite these problems.
Right.
Now, what can we do to address these problems? So the issue, as I've mentioned, has been that within these private parcels, the private developers, they built infrastructure. Within the private parcels, there's roads, there is some sewage treatment, there is pipes, and so forth. It's just that the transactions costs of making deals across these different parcels and building the large scale didn't happen. So one thing we can do is think, well, let's just make the parcels bigger. right? Let's just extend the property line. Since infrastructure was built within the property line, let's make the property line bigger. And there's a few models here, one from the United States and one from India. The one from the United States, I think everyone's familiar with, Disney World. Disney World is a private city built in the middle of these Florida swamplands. The Disney Corporation essentially provides its own security. It has its own police force. It has its own fantastic sewage and a garbage collection system. You know, when you put things in the garbage in Disney World, it is vacuum sucked, you know, through these pipes underneath Disney World. And it's all, you know, incredibly efficiently high technology taken and recycled, distributed, and so forth. It, of course, has hotels, which are just like apartments. They're just occupied, you know, for shorter periods of time. It has its own transportation network. It's got the monorail, but it's also got, you know, parking and car network for cars. So it really is a city which is large enough to have, in the economic speak, to have internalized the externalities. It's large enough to be able to have built the infrastructure at low cost. It's got its own power plant and so forth. So I think we could do something similar in other parts of the world. And let's keep in mind that the developing world is urbanizing incredibly rapidly. So we're not going to see too many new cities in the United States. But in India, in China, Vietnam, other places in the developing world, we're going to see many, many more large cities over the next several decades. So if we can establish today a better model for building these cities, that's going to have an influence hundreds of years into the future.
What would be the reason that an average person would want to live in a private city? I mean, and when we say a private city, by the way, how exactly is it run? Maybe I should ask you that. I mean, it's not like ABC Corporation runs the city. What do we really mean when we say private city in terms of governance?
Right. So my ideal kind of system, there's a few different types of ways of looking at this. An ideal kind of system would have, I think, 5 to 7 of these very large scale or reasonably large scale private developments all within the same area. So you could fit 5 to 7 Disneylands in Gurgaon, for example. And you need 5 to 7. That's going to keep costs down. That's going to keep competition between these cities. That's going to keep some efficiencies, some room for experimentation, innovation, and so forth. Then the way the city would be run, at least at the beginning, is sort of like a hotel. Like a hotel is like a mini city. People live there. It has some common areas. It has some places where you get food and restaurants and so forth. It's sort of like a hotel. And so at the beginning, at least, these cities would rent out, perhaps on long-term leases, but would rent out land. And the virtue of that system, where this land is rented, is that the more the city invests in infrastructure and in planning and building a beautiful city, building a city which works efficiently, the higher the land rents are going to be. So you can actually run the entire city on land rents, and the more efficient the city gets, the more it can charge for the land. And so you get an optimal balancing of benefits and costs. The city says, well, should we install underground pipes? Should we put our electricity underground so that we don't, when there's a storm, you know, we don't lose power? And it says, well, yeah, that's going to make our land worth so much more. The firms are going to be willing to pay more. So yes, let's do that. So, you know, unlike in a conventional city where you have to rely on voting, which is not a very efficient method of figuring out what people want, in a voluntary city, a private city, you can rely on the market process to a much greater extent.
What is exciting to me is just the prospect of competition, that people can see for themselves. Here's a city that you might want to live in, and here's a different city that you might want to live in that's structured according to a completely different model, and we can let them compete against each other and see which one wins in terms of who wants to live there, which one seems like a model for the type of lifestyle you'd like to have. I think it's a great way to show the world what we're talking about in books and papers. They can actually live it. They can see it for themselves. I have on my shelf, by the way, a book that you co-edited, I mentioned to you before we went on, some years ago, called The Voluntary City, and it's got a series of contributions by a number of scholars. So you've been thinking about issues like this for some time, but I'm sorry to say I have not gotten to that, but I've always wanted to. What are some interesting ideas in there that might be tied into this general theme?
So if I don't say my saying so, it's a great book. You should definitely take a look at it. What that does is collects a number of historical examples of privatized services around the world. There's some great material in there, for example, by the historian Stephen Davies on private policing. You know, before 1830, 1840 or so, Britain had no public police. And indeed, when the public police came to Britain, nobody really wanted them. The public didn't want them because they knew that the reason for the public police was actually to suppress the Chartists and the suffragettes and people who had wanted change. So the public police were not a very welcome presence. So how was policing? How did they handle policing in Great Britain, you know, before the public police? And essentially what people did, it's a very interesting system, there's some vestiges of it still left, is you joined a sort of an insurance company. Just as you would have fire insurance, you would have theft insurance, except not only would the theft insurance cover what you lost, it would cover funds to pay for a prosecutor, to pay for detectives to go after the people who had done the theft. So you would have private security, but also private detectives. And of course, insurance firms for very large, when you insure a diamond or something very large like that, they still do have private detectives. So there's like I said, there's the vestiges of this old system, which still remains.
I'm going to link to that book and a couple of your other titles on the show notes page. This is episode 371, so that'll be tomwoods.com/371. I'll also link to the paper that we've been discussing. I'll link to Marginal Revolution and more information about you. So tomwoods.com/371 is the clearinghouse for this episode to get the most out of what we've been talking about. Alex, thanks for your time. Very interesting stuff. I don't know very many people working on stuff like this, and I was glad to have a chance to talk to you about it.
Been great talking with you, Tom.
Okay, everybody, a couple quick things here. I think tomorrow I might try and have a look at that Indiana law that everybody's talking about. I'm always slow on these things. You guys know I'm just overwhelmed with projects, and I'm hoping to be out from under them in about a month's time. But in the meantime, you know, for me, this is pretty quick, actually, to get to the Indiana law. So I might just talk about that just in an episode on my own tomorrow, and you can tune in and listen to that. Make sure and subscribe to the show, of course, on iTunes or Stitcher, because I release a new episode every weekday, and we've covered quite an array of topics in these 371 episodes so far. Remember, the entire library of episodes is available, obviously, on iTunes. Well, actually, on iTunes, you're only allowed to have, I guess, 301 episodes at a given time, and then they start taking the early ones off. So eventually, I'll have to do an archive show on iTunes to get the old ones back up there, and I'll get to that sometime over the summer. But if you really do want those early episodes, the whole list of episodes can be found at tomwoods.com/episodes. And of course, if you are a regular listener of this show and you like it, then I guarantee you will also enjoy my new book, which is Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. A lot of refutations of critics of libertarianism, but so much more in there. Sections on the Fed, on federalism, that sort of thing, wink, wink, on U.S. history, all kinds of topics that I'm sure you guys enjoy because you are listeners of this show. Well, you're really going to like this book, I think. It's my favorite one that I've done so far. It's the only one I've self-published, and I've had such success with self-publishing that I'm not sure I would really want to go back to the old way. I mean, I could be talked into it, I suppose, but right now I'm inclined to stick with self-publishing. But anyway, you can check out a special site I set up for that book, which is realdescent.com. And in fact, I read the audiobook version myself, and you can get that for free via the offer that you'll find through tomwoodsaudio.com. All right, so make sure and join us again tomorrow. Thanks, everybody.
The Tom Woods Show.